So, welcome to Food Conversations Season 3. Food Conversations, a program about everything to do with food, starting with planting seeds and then on to growing, harvesting, distributing, and eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shoe Swap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shoe Swap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Now, before we continue, I would like once again to acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Now, today I'm delighted to welcome into our studio Afke Zonderland, founder and owner of Okanagan Rossum Natural Foods, Inc. Welcome, Afke.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
We're delighted to have you in the studio. And now that COVID is sort of waning somewhat, having guests in the studio is really a delight. It's much more pleasant. We can really have a good conversation. Now, as I was thinking about today's show, and we'd had a conversation before the show, it struck me that there were some important sort of life lessons that everyone listening could learn from, involved not just with the food sector, but with ambition to start new things. So I'm going to lay out for Afke some suggestions of lessons that I think people can learn. And Afke, if you would just comment on them, and then we're going to get into some of your trajectory in getting to where you are now. So here's the first lesson. It's never too late to change direction in your life. Now, listeners may not be aware that Afke began this successful new business, Okanagan Rossum, after she'd had a successful career in a completely different area, but always there's a relationship between them. It can sometimes even be easier to start up when you've been around the block a few times. So, Afke, do you think that's a valid lesson that somebody could learn from you?
Absolutely. Certainly, it's never too late to change and see what's needed at the time. And because I've always been a foodie, a farm foodie, really, and I've always loved good food. It needs to look good, taste good, and be nutritious. So, I learned to listen to people actually during my interior design business, and especially when it came to helping them to have a really functional, beautiful kitchen. Because it doesn't matter how beautiful a kitchen is, it has to function.
It has to work.
And this is the same thing for us as human beings walking on three legs with a gut and a mind and a heart.
Okay, second lesson. Women can start up and run a business on their own and do very well. Do you think that's a good lesson that people could learn from you?
Absolutely. And it is shown that women entrepreneurs, even though at the very beginning had very less funding and support, a hard time to get money for loans from the banking, that has completely changed. And we've seen some powerhouses out there who run extremely well-functioning and important businesses.
On a recent show, I interviewed Lana Popham, the Minister of Agriculture, who, as a woman, also pointed out that the federal Minister of Agriculture is a woman. And she appointed a head of one of the local food councils as a woman. And the council had never had a woman before. And they were sort of a little bit taken aback, but by golly, they did. They finally came around, and it's terrific. It's worked out very well. Third lesson. A successful business enterprise can begin in a rural home in the boonies just as well as it can everywhere else. Now, Afke, this is a lesson that I think you have to own.
Well, yes. And as a farm kid, we were always attracted to get back on a farm. We have a small property out in Grindrod, which is decidedly the boonies on a little country road. And it was just, I think, a sense of we just have to try this. I wasn't going to sink a whole lot of money in it without it could prove itself. Because we've seen lots of Shark Tank ventures going big and sinking themselves into deep debt by big ideas that weren't really appropriate for the time. So I borrowed $10,000 out of my husband's bank account, full signing authority. It's the only way to roll.
You told him.
And, well, I'm sure it came back in many good meals and washing and cleaning his home and underwear. But
underwear. Remember that, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. And so after a year, we broke even. Second year, I would have been able to pay back the money, but...
Well, let's not get ahead of it, because there's one more lesson.
Okay.
And this lesson, I think, is probably a central lesson for you and your life and for many other people. And I think it's an important one. At least I think it's important. If you're doing something you really believe in, and if you've learned to believe in yourself, and especially if you're energetic and you know how to work hard, many things are possible.
Absolutely. It becomes with probabilities, and then you go into possibilities, and you just start. At some points, you have to just not stand beside the road and wait for the bus. You get on the bus and start working.
Well, that's I love that expression. Stand, wait for the bus. We're gonna get on the bus of your life, because I think, as with many guests on this show, the way you get to where you are now shows that there's a kind of a continuity in life, and factors that start out at the beginning lead inevitably to what happens later on. Now, you were born and raised on a rural Dutch dairy farm right after World War II. Right after World War II, seems to me, it was an important time, and it shaped many things in your life at that time.
I think there's a similarity in some ways to where we are now to what it was then. And as a child, I was still present when stories around the dinner table went back to what happened during the war. Nights of planes going over Friesland and coming back in the morning. People hiding in the haylofts.
And the sense of an existential threat. It was a real existential threat
real.
To people's lives.
It was real. It was lived daily. And the courage of the people to help one another and to stand strong and to find ways to go on with their life while there was danger around every corner. There was no freedom. And that, I think, is the biggest lesson we can learn today. Draw the line in the sand. Draw the line in the sand. This is what we can live with. This is what we can do about it. This is what we're going to be sneaky about. And that, to me, is survival.
Well, you early on learned, even though the war had ended, you learned about things like starvation in Amsterdam, better food in rural areas, but still a struggle at all times.
Yes.
Your parents sheltered Jews who were trying to escape the Nazis.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a real, and that was dangerous.
And underground workers.
Yes, yes. Who could have been killed if you didn't rescue them.
Oh, yes.
So that sort of, as I understand it, factored into the fact that everybody worked hard on your farm. You were trying to regain what had been lost.
Yeah.
So you went out in the middle of the night to milk the cows in the field.
Yes.
In the rain, and you just had to do it.
There was no escaping it. And it was fair. It was, everybody had allotted chores. Hmm. And it was fair. It was a time on Sunday mornings. It was just my time so that my brothers could go out and play the town at night and sleep in. Fair.
And they were four of them, and they were rambunctious and noisy.
Oh, yes.
It was not a quiet home.
No, I was the little shrimp in the family. So, yeah, you learn to kind of, I think, stand your ground up to a point.
Sure. Stick up for yourself.
Yeah.
Well, I think you've demonstrated that in subsequent years, definitely. One of the phrases you said to me the other day was, life is tough, kids, so suck it up.
Yes.
You couldn't afford to be overly sentimental.
No.
Now, in addition to doing things like going out in the fields in the night, your father would have to do things like mouth-to-mouth resuscitation of a calf that was struggling. And if things didn't work, that calf ended up on the dinner table, because you couldn't afford this sort of sentimentality.
No. I think at a young age, you learn that the death of an animal and the financial loss, certainly for a farmer, is part of farming. And just when the hay was about to be harvested, darn it, it rained. Or the tractor broke down, the baler broke down. And of course, as kids, you also learn if you want a favor from your dad, you do it after the harvest is in. And mom said it was okay.
Well, timing is everything. And,
yes.
And we'll be talking about timing with respect to your life, too. Another thing that your father did, which I think is interesting for people today to hear about, was that he was one of the first people to use DDT. And after the war, DDT was a magical chemical in everybody's mind. It was sort of a solution to so many problems. And that was how it was presented to you, right?
It was safe. As kids, Dad was spraying the roses, and we just toddled on behind him.
No sense of concern.
No, no. Sense. No.
Well, it's. I'm glad to say that kind of thinking has pretty much gone out of business. You also had to hop in your bike when you started to go to secondary school and just pedal off for 12 kilometers. You were the bus. You were all on the bus, your own buses.
Yeah, large groups.
Yeah.
The closer we got to school, the bigger the group was.
And you had a transition in education where you could have gone into sort of the mathematical side of things or to languages.
Yeah.
Were those the two choices that you were offered, basically?
Yes. Mm. Linguistic, maybe more artistic side, or the math side, whether it is left brain or right brain, accounting or
sciences.
Yeah. And I had greater skills in languages, and, well, it appealed to me, and it proved to be pretty helpful down the line.
So how many languages did you end up learning?
Well, in school, we had 4 or 5 years of French, English, German, and then, of course, Dutch literature, and my native tongue is actually Fries, which is a completely different language.
Is it? What's it more closely related to beyond Dutch?
I think the difference is like Welsh and English.
Oh, that's a huge difference.
Frisian is an Anglican-based language.
Yes.
Dutch is a Germanic-based language.
Yeah. Welsh is Celtic, and a Celtic language. Very, very different.
Yeah.
Completely different. And you worked hard at school.
We had... we even went to school Saturday mornings, and came home with 4 hours of homework regularly.
Now, we talked at the beginning of the show about lessons, and I have a sense that one lesson that you told me about was that if you want to build a nation, you have to build it with community. You have to build it with the community. Waiting for politicians, corporations is going to take too long. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
I think we all need to realize our potential as individuals, that we are much more powerful of making changes. And it depends on the choices we make in the shopping aisles. When you don't buy something, it doesn't come back. It disappears. It's the same with our business. If there's no reordering, we would have been dead in the water. And so really, mind what goes home with you, what goes in your shopping basket. Not only are some of the foods junk. Shh.
Sorry, there's nobody listening but you and me and our Dan, our engineer.
They're not valuable to us.
Sure.
And still, you pay huge amounts of prices. And so shop clean, shop nutrition, and look for good deals.
Yes.
And above all, grow some of it yourself. That's where the fun starts.
Yes, I'm sure a lot of listeners have had a garden when they were a kid and found it very, very delightful.
Yeah.
So let's go back to you finished school.
Yep.
And you're thinking what you're going to do. And the first thing you thought of was going to England, but your father wasn't keen on that idea. He thought that was a bad idea.
He thought I was too young, and I was 19. But of course, as a 19-year-old, you're really smart. You know everything. And but so we bent a little, and I was able to go and have an amazing year in Canada. My aunt lived in the Vancouver area, and then another half a year with another sister of my mother's who lived in Holland, Michigan.
And what was that like, going to this big country that has, from this little country to this big country that got mountains and trees and all sorts of stuff?
It was amazing. And I should tell you that Canada actually paid for me to come. We had landings money. My trip was paid for. I got Canadian dollars at the airport in Amsterdam so that I had a bed to pay for when I arrived.
And Afika, how did that work? Did you apply for the money?
Yeah, I got a visa. And that's what it was. And it was the same whether you went to Australia or South Africa. Trips were paid for.
This was a post-war thing to encourage
Canada
travel.
Needed vibrant young people.
Well, there you are.
There
you
are.
they bought one.
Yes. But the trip from Montreal to Vancouver, that was the real eye-opener. I couldn't believe people had bacon and eggs for breakfast in the train. Because I spent my landings money on upgrading my trip to a sleeper, meals included, $56 all the way from Montreal.
Oh, my goodness. It's considerably more of that than that now, but my goodness.
It was an amazing trip across the prairies.
Now, when you got back to Holland, to the Netherlands, you met a gent who was subsequently going to become an important part of your life.
Yeah.
John.
And John wanted to go immigrate when I got back. And I wasn't keen. Mm. I nixed Australia, and then together we went.
Why was Australia not suitable?
I just, too far.
Okay, sure.
Too expensive to go back and forth.
Absolutely.
And then we went to evenings. There were evenings all over the Netherlands where South Africa was promoted as a place to immigrate to. You had videos. And we didn't like the segregation part of South Africa.
Apartheid.
Yeah, the apartheid. So Canada was it.
Number three.
But the best choice ever.
Turned out to be a good choice.
You bet.
And John wanted to, like, had this sort of vision of being a pioneer in the frontier of the empire.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But in fact, the business that he started up was actually kind of more I don't know if urban, but it was house painting. That's the kind of business he started to set.
Well, he was trained. In the Netherlands, you go into apprenticeships. Oh. So he was a master painter and started as house painting and then ended up with a crew. And from there on in, was great sailing. And it worked wonderfully well together with my interior design business, of course.
When this is something that has happened in many European countries, that there are programs to train people, even for something like painting a house. It's not just assumed that you'll automatically do it. Did that give him a bit of a leg up when he came to Canada, having this certification, this training program under his belt?
He certainly felt that way. But there were many, many changes here. People worked differently. And the system that worked in the Netherlands, like round brushes rather than rectangular brushes, John decided, wait a minute, this is way better. So he learned a lot of things that just worked better, new innovative ideas and improvement. Hmm. And I said, and then going back to Holland 20 years later, and they're still using round brushes, he said, what? So that's just interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. This whole business of coming to Canada was sort of an adventure. It was leaving things behind. And one thing you commented on when we were speaking earlier was about how many rules and sort of restrictions there are back home in Europe, in many countries in Europe. And Canada seemed like a place where you were free of some of those.
Yes, it's changed. And of course, in the Netherlands, being a small country, many people, I don't know if it's different in Holland now. In a way, good rules can work for you. For instance, in the Netherlands, at some point, the farmers were obliged to get new equipment so that the manure, the fluid manure, was brought in under the sod so there's no runoff in ditches.
Yeah, and a problem that we still have here in BC.
2 years later, ducks were in the pond again with, you know, live food. So some of them are very protective of the environment.
Yes.
Because, I mean, the Netherlands is a great big delta. So it comes, all the industrial effluent comes down the rivers. So they were very, their water table is so low to start off with. They were always very, very, very protective of their waterways. And it's like that still. And there's still a ban on genetically modified crops for the farmers.
I learned many years ago that Holland was one of the very first countries to get away from chlorination of water and to go to filtration systems for water purification. At the time when, here in BC, the only way you could get money from the provincial government in a small town like this was to chlorinate the water supply.
Yeah.
And several people, including myself, opposed it, and we used Holland. I used Holland as an example to our city council, but they said the government in Victoria will not give us the money, so we have no choice.
Yeah.
And they didn't really want to do it. But it's interesting, when you're also below sea level in much of the country, you start to think about how you run things with respect to water. It's a very important issue. So at a certain point, you'd already had a couple of your girls had been born in Richmond, but you had a yen to move out into the same rural environment that you'd been in when you were growing up. And how did that happen? You had a little bit of a trajectory there.
Yeah, we wanted to go back to a farm community. And we have a cousin in, well, Garden Lake, and visiting him, we loved it here. And his wife was really keen on doing some real estate businesses, and she kept an eye out for us. And that's how we ended up on Strolsha Road. And it's been a heavenly place for 42 years. And
it cost you the same amount as the home that you were in Richmond.
$35,000 for a lot in Richmond, $35,000 for 9 acres up in the Okanagan. How could we lose? And half of that was pasture. A beautiful alfalfa pasture.
Already.
So it was amazing. And the cousin started building our house, and by the time spring came around, the well had to come first. And we are blessed.
Water.
We have water.
Yes.
We have beautiful water and enough water to water, you know, our gardens. And we're growing quite a lot of our own food, so we need a good well.
The Water Act is very strict about how you can deal with water. And if someone has water and a water line, for example, across your property, you can't interrupt it for anything if they're depending on that as water. It's the Water Act is very protective of water supply for any rural landowner. Very interesting how that works. Now, you began your hippie phase, as you called it. Your hippie phase, living in the country, growing your own food, raising kids, and having horses. Your beloved horses. Your horses you had begun to love in Holland, and you continue to love them here in Canada.
Yeah, it was my happy place, always. And I felt obliged to earn some money for their keep. I didn't think that should be on John. And so you start looking for jobs, and eventually it ended up with a course in interior design. And even though some people say, oh, nobody's ever going to pay you a dime for picking the paint color.
But you did far more than that. And this was around a time you told me that you felt you hadn't done anything with your life. You wanted to get your teeth into something.
Yep. Yeah. And the word career sounded like much fancier than stay-at-home mom. And, of course, I now know the value. And our daughters, all, you know, for 12 years, I was home.
And they had you there.
School,
with them.
You know, volunteering at the school, and then kindergarten, and then graduation. It was good.
The appreciation pays off in huge amounts later on. So you grew your own food. Your third daughter, Anna, was born in Enderby.
Yep.
So she's a country girl from the beginning. And then you took this course at Okanagan College in Vernon. What was it that you hoped, like at the beginning, you were interested in the design process, but as you started to work, well, you had a break with Heronview.
Yes,
that was a sort of a gave you a bit of a leg up in getting started. Describe how that worked.
Well, I walked in there like promoting the service, and she said, well, the lady that worked there at the time, Sean, we're still friends. She said, do my house. If it looks half decent, she worded it way nicer, then you can do our second show home. And that was agreed upon. My budget wasn't quite as big as a really fancy show home.
And that was helped by the fact that you worked out of your own home.
Yes.
And you had the overhead was
no overhead.
Much less.
No overhead. And so that worked out really well. And from there on, you get to know contractors and through friends. And then it worked out. It just rolled from one job to the other. And I expanded towards commercial design. I did the Honda new building and the courthouse renovation for Dan Kobe, the dentist office. And they were wonderful jobs, creative. And I think what kept its appeal for me for all those years was you listen to people's needs, to their dreams, and you find creative solutions, visually pleasing, and the communication with people, listening to them.
You indicated that you learned to listen. The family structure of rambunctiousness and people talking at once was replaced by a capacity to listen and to hear what people are actually saying to you.
Yep. It's an eye-opener, and also sometimes you misunderstand. If I don't listen or we don't get it right the first time, you start over, like rip in the garbage. And it's not personal. It's just I missed something. They didn't communicate clearly. It's a process. Relationships is a process.
And it's much more than just the design part. It's the relationship part.
Absolutely. And so you start to see their dream. And then we go shopping.
Now, Afka, you mentioned earlier about this combination of function and beauty, attractiveness. It seems to me that was a theme in your work in interior design.
Absolutely. I started off always giving them a questionnaire, especially when it was a kitchen. How do you cook? Is there two in the kitchen? How do you shop? Do you shop in bulk? How many dishes do you have? Do you do fancy dishes, daily dishes? How do you store places? Do you need a big pantry, a small pantry? How many appliances you have? Small appliances, are they sitting on the counter? And final question, big one for me, where do you store your knives? If people say, oh, they're in the drawer, I thought, uh-oh. Sharp knives is a big deal. Chopping skills is the joy of every chef.
Sure.
And so that was actually one of the first skills I learned in California when I went to raw food school.
How to use a knife?
How to use a knife.
Well, we'll all be careful around you now that we know you how to use a knife.
Yeah.
This really kind of... You said at one point that you were kind of shy when you were young, but I mean, with four little brothers, most sisters might be a little bit intimidated by this noise. But this you really became part of an engagement process between yourself and your clients.
I learned it's not all about you; it's about them, and fit in. You know, try to find solutions for them that stand the test of time. And in that, there is so much satisfaction. And you come home with always a new problem, because building a home is a 4-month process with 1,000 different decisions. Money, tiling, quality, expenses, da-da-di-da-di-da. It's a long list, and people are overwhelmed. And especially overwhelmed when husband-wife team have different ideas.
that can be an issue.
Yes, and
I've read about that in a book somewhere. I don't know anything.
Yes, he's the budget guy, and he said, "My wife makes all the decisions."
Except when they cost too much, as far as he's concerned.
Yeah. And so that was usually the first listening ear. Okay, who's paying the bills? And so you balance it out. But I find when you put the whole package together and present it to both, give or take, or you go shopping. They said, I would take people to the store, new floors, wherever in town, and or the kitchen places. Tell me what you like the best of all. Give me one item that you just said, I must absolutely have that. And then you go from there. Or they have a favorite piece of furniture. They said, for the guys, what color is your car? What truck are you driving? And it's always the same deal. You look at their truck, and then you open their closet. It's usually a lot of the same colors.
Honestly, I think I'm learning something about it. How a quality internal interior designer works that I never thought about before. You also were able to pay for your horses.
Yes, big time. And my horses got to be a little bit more expensive, and the lessons got to be a little bit more expensive, and it was, heaven on earth.
It was an ideal decision.
Yes.
You didn't have to have a budget prepared for you by somebody else.
No.
But there was a part of you that, as you were approaching the end of like your 50s, there was sort of a feeling that something happened and you wanted to expand. What was going on in your mind at that time?
Well, one of my things is, okay, been there, done that, move on. And it was great. And I always think you need to stay as long as it's great. When it's kind of fun, okay, been there, done that, move on. And food was the next best thing. And I didn't want to just be regular food. It had to be something different. And I'm afraid my mind walks away with me when it comes to imagination. And when I came across beautiful raw desserts, I thought, what is it with this?
Where did you find these beautiful raw desserts?
Oh, well, I read cookbooks as entertainment, okay. Right? And Alive magazines, like up-to-date magazines that are at the forefront. And I thought, I need to learn more about this. So we took a little trip to California, and turned out to be the basis of workshops that then became making a product for the retail stores.
So your trip to California was a trip to Fort Bragg, which is a small community on the coast in Northern California, where the Living Light Culinary Arts Institute is located. How did you find out about this particular location? This is
online. I was looking for a course.
Uh-huh.
I was looking for something new. So at that point, you go online, even, 20 years ago, almost. And that's where it popped up. And I thought, okay. And
did it stick? What made it stick in your mind? Because it's, raw foods are, of course, they have some spectacular advantages. But what was it about this particular place?
The approach was fresh. And also, from a nutritional standpoint, it was not over-processed. It was minimally touched by heat or frying. It was in its natural state. And I think that's where the connection with the farm grew. Background. And one of my dad's favorite saying was always, the health of my cows is in the health of the soil. So we've come back round circle, and that today is especially important.
Sure, that's a basic principle of what's
basic
called regenerative
principle.
Agriculture.
And our soil is not what it used to be.
Mm.
And our food is not as nutritionally dense as it used to be. So then what we do capture, let's not just mess with it so much with heat and frying and poor combination and sprays on them. Whoever thought that was a good idea?
With respect to that, we've talked about this before on the program, that when you use herbicides and insecticides, mm-hmm. you actually reduce the presence of defense compounds in foods, and the defense compounds are often the flavors, the flavor sources.
Yeah.
And by preventing the plant from having to do any work to defend itself, you actually make it taste more bland and less flavorful. Sherry Soria, and Dan Lederman, the two proprietors. Sherry's written a number of books.
Yes.
Raw Food Revolution Diet. I guess you must have read that book at some point.
I have it in the cupboard. And when I started doing the workshops and printed some of the recipes and copied, I think this has to stop. I made my own little recipe book, and that was a handout for my workshops. I had 3 week. One morning a week workshops that went from the business of the basic foundation of sprouting and growing your own microgreens to doing a four-course meal. And where the little cookbook came in.
And that led you down to Granville Island.
Yes.
What happened there?
Well, there's an edible island, and it's still there. It's now Edible Canada, but it was Edibles BC. And I came across them, and I thought, huh, well, that sounds interesting. I can do that. So I phoned Eric Pateman, who was the owner, and still might be the owner. He had dinners with guest chefs. And I thought, am I a chef? Well, what the heck? So he phoned. And he said, well, if you can prepare a four-course meal, we supply the wines for every meal, and you can talk while you work, and it has to be about 20 people to make a go of it, you're welcome. And lo and behold.
So he would advertise for you and say, you know,
this
guest is coming from the wilds of interior BC.
Raw food. And you know what? Some chefs showed up. Roundhouse in Vancouver, a couple of chefs. I didn't know it at the time. It would have been hugely intimidating. But at the end of it, they came to me and said, this is the first dinner that we've ever been to where we are not feeling totally bloated and a little tipsy. And how do you do that? How do you bind a dessert without starches, without cooking? So I thought, the innovation part of it was intriguing, and probably for three, four years, they filled. All the classes, all the shows filled.
Really?
It was amazing. And they paid like $84. This is like at least 10 years ago, $84 for a meal of basically nuts and seeds and green vegetables.
My goodness, that is impressive. I'm just trying to think of what my last budget from the grocery store was. It was, the whole bag was $84. What was it that people, I mean, the two chefs, winning over some chefs is a very important thing, because they're going to be talking to other chefs and they're going to be spreading the word to their customers and that kind of thing. What was it that seemed to, I mean, obviously had a good eating experience.
Yeah.
Did they go on to incorporate raw foods into what they were doing?
Not that I know of.
Hmm.
One of the neatest meals, raw food deal meals, was at Crowfoot Liquor Store in Calgary. And I thought, cowboy town? Beef town? How can that fly? There were 30 people. It was a complete sellout. And again, we had a sommelier there, and they teamed, of course, their wines or their aperitifs and with the meal. And so that made it really enjoyable. It was also a teaching dinner.
So you were doing a teaching or?
Both.
Okay.
The sommeliers and then paired it, and it was a selling feature. And I've had still some people that now probably buy our products in the store. And the fresh food thing and the innovation of it, to this day, really, I haven't seen any products like ours on the shelf.
Well, that's probably, we'll be talking about where your products have gone, and that will become clear as what you just said, what it actually means. Now, around 2005, your daughter said, Anna said,
yeah,
Mom, you got to start selling something out there. You've got to start selling your products. What happened there?
Well, they were delicious. And so I ended up making a batch, all hand batch, in little Excalibur dehydrators in the basement, and went to the Wildflight Farm market in town, the organic market, and basically out of the back of the car, and came home with $500. Not all profit, but I thought, okay.
This can work.
This can work. It's travel money, like $1,000 a month or so to play money. And it was fun. Although there were people, oh, what's Afka doing? You know, selling cookies out of the back of her car. It didn't sound very prestigious.
Oh.
But I thought, who cares? I just want to change.
If they give you money for your product... Who cares about the prestige?
So we carried on, and from one flavor came two flavors, and we now have six flavors. Mm. And because I learned that it was important to give people a choice.
Somewhere along the line, you found a food angel.
Yes.
Tell listeners about your food angel.
Well, I gave a class at the Okanagan College here, and at the last moment, I did have... the word escapes me, PowerPoint. You need equipment to get it on the front. I didn't have an extension cord, and I was getting messed up, and people were arriving, and this one hand comes up, would you like some help? Yes, please. And since then, Sherry has been my number one food angel. She was behind me at workshops, at home, and wherever we went, we traveled together. She came with me to California, a wonderful trip down the Oregon coast, and she's still
involved.
My back.
She sounds like a good organizer and keeps track of things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She keeps me squared away.
So let's talk a little bit about the connection, the carryover from your interior design business and food. So when you were working as an interior designer, you would connect to people, you would try and find out what they wanted, and then you would try and give it to them, and you would follow up, and you would establish this sort of ongoing relationship. Now, obviously, creating food is a little different in terms of, because you give the product to them already made. But there were some principles there that you talked about earlier. One is that something has to be both visually attractive but also productive and functional, has to work. How did that carry over into you as you started up your business, this idea that food had to be attractive, taste good, look good, smell good?
Well, food is the biggest impact on our social connection with our friends. Dinner evenings, amazing, always. Over food, the best conversations happening. And of course, we have our five senses, touch, feel, emotions, all of those things. And like interior design, you were looking for balance, color balances, textural balances, light and dark, space, all of these things, they play a role, because big texture like carpets and draperies, they change the sound of a room. Now, open spaces, all hard flooring, hard window dressings, they make it hollow. So there's an issue about that. And you can cover it, and you can change things a little bit. And I think with food on your palate, there's the five flavors, salt, sweet, sour, bitter. And there has to be a balance. And most things, if you're playing with food, especially soups and sauces and things like that, homemade soups, often they can be a little bland. Making a good soup is like really, really nourishing and just hits the spot. Nothing hits the spot than a beautiful soup when you come home for a good ski. So there has to be texture, which is fiber in food, visually, I mean, not all chilies look so appealing. It's brown.
You said something to me the other day. You said you eat first with your eyes.
Yes. If you're looking at all to any cooking shows and see chefs, look at their body posture. They are hovering over their food and a little here and a little there. They put their heart and soul in making it look good. A little, you know, squiggle with the balsamic oil vinegar mix. And I'm thinking, wow, but it's not just that it looks good. You know that this flavor of oil and sour and sweet is just what that rice or what that dish needed, or soften the blow from a really hot curry. So to me, they work with the body and their heart and their knowledge and experience.
And the food that you eat has to be good for you. It has to, you use the three words, nourish, balance, and cleanse.
Yes.
Those three principles need to be in the food, right?
Just like your car. You put really good gas in, but you make sure it's clean.
And you hope it's clean anyway.
Yeah, and try switch diesel with regular. There's problems. And I think more people know way more about how to keep their car operating smoothly as they do or take care of their bodies. So pay attention. How you feel. Am I energetic? Or does this make me want to go have a sleep on the sofa? So to me, food is about energy. It's about vibrancy. And plants, living plants, their vibrancy touches you.
So underlying these immediate factors, there's also the notion of what kind of ethics, what kind of values you pursue when you're creating food. It's not just any old food. It's got to have some broader significance in the world. Would that be fair to say?
Quality, quality, quality. Learn what quality food looks like, smells like. And don't put your money towards food that does not qualify. Not for your beautiful, energetic body. Doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter what you do. You want to be your best you can be each and every day. And that comes with eating vibrantly alive food and thought.
Absolutely. And speaking of thought, one thought that we discussed was that the idea that your most productive years are when you're in your 20s or your 30s. I mean, certainly the most physical energy and running around takes place at that time, and experimenting and maybe not always having things work out. But in your 60s and 70s, you've been around the block a few times and you don't get thrown off by things. And in fact, there is some scientific evidence, some research evidence, that the most productive years in a person's life are after the age of 60, not before. What do you have to say about that? Because I think you qualify.
Oh, thank you. Yay. It comes together. All these different puzzle pieces, the big puzzle of your life, you've placed a lot of pieces and you see the whole picture. And you see something really beautiful emerging. Not every day. We're not perfect. We're human. But every puzzle looking back, every puzzle piece looking back has served a purpose to completing the picture that you want your life to be. And more, it's less about having and more about doing and doing things, going around it in the right way, where you have a great love for society, a great love for your family and the people you go in contact with. So I think it's super important to, before you start your day, how can I best impact my knowledge or my personhood to make somebody else happier? Give them some gifts that serve them well.
Well, let's talk about how those gifts started out, because initially you were dehydrating in your basement and you were flooding the house with humidity.
Yeah.
That was a problem.
Mold is a problem, a big one. And so we saw it coming, and then in the wintertime to open the doors, that's not great either.
Freeze to death.
No. So at that point, I connected with the Small Scale Food Processing Association, a great organization. There are so many small companies like mine operating in British Columbia. And at one speech, when a minister of agriculture did the speech at an event where we placed as one of BC's best small businesses, he said that British Columbia thrives. 58% of the workforce are employed by small businesses.
And do you remember roughly how many small businesses there were?
I think we placed in the top five out of about 900.
Okay, so 900 businesses and 58% of the workforce. Pretty substantial.
And they were very supportive, and that was actually a wonderful event that we had. We were top five of the People's Choice Award, and then the year after we were top five of having impact in the community. And wonderful.
But you didn't want to steam your house. You had you took a big step with help
from the SSFPA. Mm-hmm. And she said, it sounds to me like you're doing something that you could qualify for a grant, and we still have some money left in the pot. Would you like to get $20,000?
Oh, you said, no, wait, please, you don't need it. So.
Yep. But the fun thing is, when Sherry and I went down to California, I stopped by in Eugene, Oregon, because I knew they had the machine that we should get.
You knew what exactly you wanted.
We took a batch of prepared cran raisin mix to Eugene, arrived there in pouring rain in the middle of the night, and their staff member came to the shop, and we spread a sheet of our cran raisin crisps.
Yes.
On this Harvest Saver beautiful machine. Picked it up the next morning, and it was voila.
So it's called a Harvest Saver?
Yeah, Harvest Saver.
And how big is the machine if you're looking?
Well, it's about 5 feet tall and at least 5 feet wide, and it has a ventilation system and a heating element that dries it beautiful and evenly. It's kind of a round, it's got a round ventilation barrel in
the
bottom.
So you don't have to turn trays around inside.
Nope,
it doesn't have to do that
anymore.
Mm. And how much can you put in? I mean, obviously you put a lot and a lot less comes out because the water's gone.
Yeah.
But how much?
Well, let me see. Weight-wise, probably hard to tell. It's 14 big trays that are 3x4. So, lots. I just know it's $700 worth every time. So when we ruin a batch, we just go
you
put
know exactly what
$700
you
on the compost pile. Or to the chickens. Usually goes to the chickens.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, compost and chickens, they're both equally meritorious in terms of a target.
Yes.
What you said it's got a ventilation system so that it doesn't ventilate into the room. It ventilates through the...
Yeah. It's connected to the outside wall.
So you're no longer humidifying the paint in your house.
No.
So that was a big turning point, getting this humongous dehydrator.
Yeah.
And then Anna started to play a role in what you were doing.
Yep.
I mean, obviously she was there from the beginning. She said, Mom, get out and start selling this stuff. But also she's now working.
Yeah, she at the time Anna had gotten married and lived in Edmonton, and she wanted to be a stay-at-home mom after she had her baby. She said, "I only see them when I come home in the dark and I leave in the dark." So her and her husband Scott moved to the Okanagan, and she became my partner and right hand, and she pretty much runs the show.
Except Sundays when you fill the dehydrator.
Yes.
You know, really, it's clearly this has been a huge shift in your life into a new kind of work, but an extension, you know, from farming, from traveling, from seeing the world, from having a business where beauty and function were united together. It must seem like you've come a long distance to get to this point.
I've always been purpose-driven. I've always had the imagination. It has to be worth something. I think that's what being alive should feel like. It's a good feeling.
I think that that sounds like a very good way to look at things, and probably, again, another one of the lessons that anyone can pick up from what you've been doing over the years. Now, on our next show, for listeners to know, we're going to talk a lot about the nuts and bolts of Okanagan Rossum, where the source materials come from, how they're distributed, how they impact the food system, because, this show is about food sovereignty. And food sovereignty means that we have control over the food we grow. And it's not just any old food. It's food that is really good, tasty, and good for us. I want to thank you, Afka, today for being with us, for sharing your story, and to tell you and listeners that we'll all be ready to have a good time next Friday when we talk about Okanagan Rossum natural foods. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Thank you.